Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
All right, folks, call is going to begin here in just a moment.
Martin? Martin?
All right, folks, call is about to begin. Just a moment here.
Martin.
Yes.
You're going live tonight?
Yes.
Pop up your Skype, please.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. My name is Martin Michelson. I'll be your moderator for this evening's call. Before we get started, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you're on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone on this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America as a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, nobody here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be, well, get an attorney. All you're going to get here is just entertainment, just folks saying what they might do. Were they similarly situated to you? Really just people's thoughts and opinions is all. Anything above and beyond that, anything in the realm of legal advice, you're going to have to get an attorney. Not what we do here. All right, on to the next subject. Let's go over a few things here with Your Remedies and the Law very quickly. First of all, let's take everybody to the homepage, www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we'll see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you have a separate page come up that just has two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though. On the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. Essentially, it's the foundation or the core structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of AMJUR, means to have at least a basic concept of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. Beside it on the right is the common law default process, where it's nationally known for its high win rate in traffic cases. That's what it's most popularly acquired for, what it's most often known for. But that's not why it's here. The reason that it's here is it pairs perfectly with the jurisdictionary course in the way of acting like a real-life homework assignment. Of course, it's also popular because, you know, let's be frank, traffic scenarios are usually on the lower end of people's anxiety level. And then, of course, with such an incredibly high win rate, folks feel very confident, stepping into a court scenario, with that process. So when you go through the jurisdictionary course, and then you turn around and in the near future you exercise the common law default process, it gives you, like I said, a real life homework scenario. So you're able to practice, what you just learned, which again for most people is how we learn. So we encourage you to pick up both of those at your earliest convenience. Of course, the jurisdictionary has a contribution of $250, and the common law default process with a contribution of $150. So also very, very affordable. All right, on to the next subject. You're probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of Your Remedy, you're met with that little blue box that pops up and asks you if you want to continue on Your Remedy where you were originally going, if you want to stop for a moment and explore Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that's at Your Remedies in the Law. But Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen different websites that all together make up the umbrella that is Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that at your leisure that you will do just that and check it out. All the different products that we offer. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider for your particular educational scenario, your particular situation, feel free to email me, that's Martin Michelson, mm@yourremediesinthelaw.com, or call the 1-800 number, 1-800-625-4250, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. All right, so let's talk about Grassfire Communications for a quick second, formerly known as Statewide Communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up, tell your friends, tell your family about it. It's completely free. It's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables you to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. You have a very easy setup. Put your name in here, click next, put your address in, click next. And then what sort of thing are you into? What topics do you like? Do you like to talk about veterans' rights? Do you like to talk about driving versus traveling? Want to talk about home foreclosure issues? Maybe credit cards is what you want to talk about. And so what this does is it puts you in contact. It puts all this information together, and then it groups you with people that are within the circle, the radius that you chose. It's really designed for people that are, you know, at least driving distance from it, that have similar interests in what you have. And so we think about it, you know, like this. Can you imagine the power that it would have for the common man if you could jump on there and let's say, you say, well, this happened to me today. Maybe the first couple of people come on there and say, oh, that stinks. I don't think that's fair. I don't think they should be able to do that. Well, you know, as much as you might share that sentiment, that's probably not going to do a lot for you, let's be honest. But maybe then the next person says, well, I'll tell you what I would do if I was similarly situated. I'd go to my county courthouse, go to the law library. Every court, county courthouse has one. And I'd get a law dictionary, and I'd look up these terms and start with that. And then here's a link to a YouTube video that will explain quite a bit about the basic fundamentals of this particular topic that you're focused on there. And maybe the next person after that comes in and says, that all sounds great idea, but I'll tell you what I'd do even more than that. Here's a product, here's a process right here at your remedies and law, for example, that'll walk you through, they'll handheld you through the entire process of educating you on this particular topic to where, you know, you come out the other side and you know exactly what to do, exactly how to begin, exactly how to end. And that's real power right there, folks. And that's all we're trying to get folks to do here is to educate themselves, to start learning, start branching out, and not being afraid to educate themselves. All right. What else do we have here? All right. Freedoms Radio. If you're maybe traveling or don't want to go through the whole process of, you know, going through logging in on the radio program, but you don't want to miss, you know, a show. So we have Freedoms Radio there for you. Go there and click the streaming button. Every call that we have is right there at Freedoms Radio. You've got archives of previous shows that you can check out. And so you don't have to ever miss a call again if you don't wish. When the option is afforded to you, when you go to your remedy is in the law, you click on the register button. You'll see that it's very affordable, $10 a month. And that gives you full access. Actually, the Freedoms Radio, I believe, actually might be limited. But the full membership there at your remedy is in the law gives you open access to everything that we have here at Americans Restoring America. Again, very affordable, $10 a month. So once you're in a position to be able to do that, we strongly encourage you to do so. All right. Winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping here before we get into the call tonight. This is your caveat emptor or your buyer beware. Your remedy is in the law, of course, is under the umbrella of Americans Restoring America. When you come aboard, you go with an information provider, you're doing just that. Information providers pay for advertising at your remedies in the law. So this payment will be an expense to that info provider along with any other expenses that could be associated with your particular educational material or process. So when you contact us, all we're simply doing is listening to your particular scenario, quickly deducing from a list of folks who would be the best fit for you to educate you on that particular matter, and then we make the introductions. Not all teachings, efforts from the information providers is always going to be successful. Everybody hopes for the best. We plan for the best. I promise you, we aim for the best. But things sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to wrestle with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. We want to emphasize, though, again, our plan is always to be successful. If you have any questions about that, we encourage you to visit yourremediesinthelaw.com/testimonials, and you'll see exactly what we mean by that. But this kind of brings us to the topic of the refund policy here at Your Remedies in the Law. Well, there is none. Not Your Remedies in the Law, anyway. Of course, again, when you go with an information provider, you're doing just that. You're going with that information provider. So any talk of a refund or credit, if that was to be the case, would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider. But even then, folks, that's very, very few and far between. It has to be pretty extreme, extenuating circumstances. The point here is you're expected to have done your due diligence and done some research before you make a final decision. Once you go with an information provider and you start the process, you're kind of locked in with that. All right, lastly, pertaining to all the information providers here at Your Remedy, we want to remind everybody that, of course, all these speakers are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn. But please, you must always be respectful. Besides, if you keep a fair and modest attitude and the information provider does the same, then we all win and we all learn. And that's what we're here for. All right, I believe that is my rant for this evening. So without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the call back over at this time to Mr. Edward, and he will introduce our speaker for this evening.
Well, thank you so very much, Martin. I appreciate that. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight is going to be a very interesting story, our call tonight, in that it is the story of a student that came to us just the other day and has issues from the past that need to be resurrected and dealt with. It's important to understand that court cases are truly never over. There's always some way to resurrect a court case. So here's the 30,000-foot view. And as we talk about this, when John joins us in just a few moments, no, he's already here. Good. Hey there, Brother John. Welcome.
Hey. Good evening, sir.
Good evening. So here's the 30,000-foot view from this student. In 2010, the student's farm had been paid off and yet had been stolen by way of small claims. In Iowa, there is no small claims court decision that can be appealed to the Supreme Court of Iowa. The student knew he had rights. The student had told Judge GPS that he had no jurisdiction over the student and unfortunately walked out. The judge violated Iowa rules of court, Chapter 51, Canon 2, Iowa Code 602.1602, and also called for the disqualification of Judge GPS as being the judge in the appeal. Isn't that cute? The sheriff walked with the student, and the student got the clerk of court to write down that everything was lawful. The student did not abandon his farm, and the student resisted eviction. The sheriff walked the student around the posted property gate. There's a witness to this fact. The magistrate who ordered this student to a psych ward was the same magistrate who handled the initial appearance for the small claims eviction. The magistrate had an ex parte with this student's ex-wife and rebellious son before the hearing. The student has a witness affidavit to that also. Many violations of the rules, and the student still doesn't know how to get into a fair court. The student is a 76-year-old Vietnam veteran who believes that there is truth, honesty, and justice somewhere to be found. The student reserved all their rights, and incidentally, be advised, this judge sealed this eviction case. So, John, that's the 30,000-foot view. And The student is here. His name is also John, so we're just going to call him Jay for his letter. And what are your thoughts on this, John?
Well, I guess this is first John talking to second John. Good evening, second John.
How you? First John, yeah. Chapter what? Five, verse what?
Yeah. Yeah, if you need me, just look me up. I'm in the book. Right. John, there's an old saying, and you and I are both very, very clear on the concept. Though a man seeks an audience with a king, it's from the Father that he gets justice. You know, and that no matter how it slices out, no matter what, and I'm not going to call this judge a scum-sucking, low-down, slimy, bottom-feeding so-and-so, so I won't. Because I don't use terms like that. Regardless of whether he is or not, I'm not going to use that term. So whatever anybody thinks, I'm not calling him a low-down, slimy, scum-sucking, bottom-feeder. By the way, John, do you know the difference between a lawyer and a catfish?
He's not muted. Well, I'll tell you what. Wait a minute. Hold on. John, you're from Davenport. You're unmuted.
Okay. I don't know what the. Can you hear me?
Yep. We can hear you.
Oh.
You know, the question is, do you know the difference between a lawyer and a catfish?
Not that one, no.
Well, one of them's a low-down, slimy, scum-sucking bottom feeder, and the other's a fish.
Ah, I heard the one about what's an attorney at the bottom of the ocean.
A good start?
Yes.
Okay. Jurisprudence is the definition of the study or hobby or pursuit of law. Jurisprudence has turned into an industry. And there's presently, there's another student right now. We're working on his appeal. The corruption in this particular town is just obnoxiously unpleasant. It's situated in Maricopa County, Arizona, and the town is Phoenix. Very, very unpleasant. I've had the honor and the privilege of working with the ex-sheriff for Maricopa County, and he's quite an honorable man, shockingly honorable. And he, like the rest of us who were over 23, it's a murder turn 23. I don't know what I'm going to do when I hit 26, but for those of us who are over 23, we're starting to see some expiration dates, and he is as well. And sometimes the expiration dates come in the form of your mobility becomes to be challenged, or, you know, arthritis, or, you know, pulmonary capacities, but hopefully not mental capacities. His mental capacities are 5x5 right now. And, after I got out of the Air Force in 76, I was at law in Southern California. I heard about a couple of sheriffs like him. And professors were holding them up. Two of my professors held them up as somebody of note and to be admired and esteemed to. This gentleman's one of those we call those type of people lone rangers. And when we have a situation like you're describing, there's that comes into some complex situation and some complex citizenship. Now, you remember something about a government of the people, by the people, and for the people? You ever heard of that?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Hey, do you remember where that came from? paragraph 2 of the preamble to the Declaration of Independence.
Okay.
And the Declaration of Independence makes it, in his Gettysburg Address, Abraham Lincoln was quoting the Declaration of Independence, paragraph 2. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed with their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among them are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. In this government, of the people, by the people, and for the people, the highest highest level of authority is the people. And when Abraham Lincoln was giving that very, very short speech on November 19th, 1863, he was reiterating the Declaration of Independence. And when people don't have time, aren't able to, don't feel capable, don't have the skill set, or maybe don't feel safe for a whole host of other reasons to doing something, they hire help. And, you know, like longshoremen, Department of Transportation workers, highway patrolmen, air traffic controllers, U.S. Forestry Service, it goes on. You know, and governors, presidents, judges, sheriffs, oh, those last four, they're not just hired help, they're temp help. And the reason why the president has the authority to negotiate treaties and et cetera, and this veto power, et cetera, is because we, the people, give it to him. The reason why a sheriff, and the sheriff, you know, they're just temp help. They apply for their job every 4 or 6 years, depending on the jurisdiction, and they have to reapply, and just like any other applicant, they have to get references and go to the employer's clerk and submit these references, 10,000 signatures or whatever, and then the employers decide who they're going to hire when it comes to the date, you know, whether it's November 7th or, you know, whichever date of the year, and they hire the help. That sheriff only has the right, he conferred the authority to arrest because the people have conferred it. And they, for the 8 hours a day that he serves as a sheriff, he subjugates his personal rights to that of the people. And he is paid to make, you know, to make arrests and to defend and serve and protect the people. Those inalienable rights that were reserved for the people were never surrendered or abdicated to the hired help. There was a case where there was a case out in West Texas many, many years ago. Let me see, it would be 25 years ago. I used to use the term elderly, a 64-year-old elderly widow, a 64-year-old widow. I don't use that term elderly anymore. That was a signpost a few mile markers back, and I feel like I'm slamming myself now when I use it. And yes, I may be a recovering 50 survivor, but she was brought into court to, under the charge of wrongful carry of a firearm, and the judge, who, was absolutely adamant about it, her daughter bought not just one firearm, but two into the courtroom. Judge says, "Is that a firearm in my courtroom?" The question was, where in the Constitution is eschewed the right to keep bear a firearm on that school ground where you charged me with, let alone your courtroom? And the judge stood up and started banging his gavel, and the bailiff started running over. The daughter passed mom a firearm, And the daughter shoved her stub nose 38 in the bailiff's ear as he was running past her. And, the judge kept banging. The lady says, "I'm sorry, you're under arrest." He says, "You can't." And she shot him in the shoulder. It wasn't a very serious wound. He died from it 3 days later, but she shot him. That little town no longer has any problems with concealed or open carry. But that justice, that gavel had already sent 9 people to prison in the 2.5 years of his term already, of his short term as a judge, and sentenced them to felony hard time. Later, Lieutenant Governor Rick Perry would submit applications for pardon for all of those individuals, and they would be, the pardons were granted. But the people get away, or will get away, with whatever they're allowed to get away. There, a gentleman walked out on the factory floor. The owner of the factory walked out and found a half a dozen gentlemen huddled behind a machine, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. And he says, "What are you guys doing? Just standing here. You're supposed to be working. What are you doing here?" And one of them turns around, looks at him and says, "We didn't know you were watching." The hired help will get away with whatever you can will choose to let them get away with. I respectfully and regrettably, I'm in the process of preparing felony grand jury indictments against 2 judges right now. It's that bad. Everybody says there's judicial immunity, and that their judges are, and they say there's things called prosecutorial immunity, and meaning that the prosecutors cannot be, you know, prosecuted, even when one was, we had a prosecutor that had exculpatory evidence, and yet he went to the grand jury and got a grand jury indictment, and we had a female prosecutor in a different state that did the same thing. Those are both currently preparing to come to trial because of the grand jury indictments that we prepared for them. Article 3, Section 1, Sentence 2 of the Constitution says, "Judges of both the Supreme and Inferior Courts shall hold their offices and during good behavior." And it's, it says they're only allowed to hold their office when they're time of good behavior. There is nothing that says, well, and the question we ask is that, is just because somebody's elected to office, does that mean that they have immunity from committing criminal behavior? What is your, you know, let's suppose we elect a state senator or a U.S. senator, and that person authors a bill that prevents you from carrying handguns openly. The fact that they just committed conspiracy against civil rights under 18 U.S.C. 241 and did it with the rest of their Senate, state or U.S., does that mean that because they're elected that that's no longer a crime, John?
No, they should be charged. Trust me, I understand that. I've known my rights for a long time. I've known who I was. I traveled, and this goes back 15 years. Long story short, I was doing 72 and a 55, got a ticket pulled over, and I wanted a business card and demanded a trial by jury. And I knew the law very well, and at that time, during the initial pretrial, the judge released 4 people on their own recognizance, and they threw me in a holding cell. I told the bailiff to arrest that judge for treason because he committed treason. And They threw me down in a holding cell with four blacks, hoping they'd beat me up. They didn't. Then they transported me across state lines to Pekin, Illinois, to keep me from gathering the evidence that I had so I could win my case. They brought me back to the for the jury trial in leg irons, both hand and feet, and the ticket would have been $59. Even at noon, they threw me in a holding cell and didn't get dinner out of it. I had a guy bring some evidence. Judge threatened me with contempt of court. And I just kept learning. Early on, you said every court has a law library. Years and years ago, we had a whole big room in the courthouse in Davenport. The chief judge threw all the books in the dumpster. Talk about a sheriff. What happens if the sheriff has been involved in felony theft under the civil rights forfeiture? I mean, I understand where you're at, and I'm not a stupid man, and I've done everything I possibly can, but I do not know where to go in this state. I even had the governor and the attorney general of this state process served because of their wrongdoing, and I don't know where to go with it.
You said process served. Could you
let me explain that.
Thank you.
Yep. The state of Iowa felt I owed state income tax. No, I did not owe any federal income tax, and therefore I did not owe state income tax. And they kept saying I did, and I kept writing back and saying I didn't. An attorney out of the governor's office in Des Moines sent a letter to South Carolina, North Carolina, where I had insurance with my youngest daughter's insurance policy. There's like $735. But they sent the letter and said there was a lien and stole that money. So I followed all the procedure I wrote to that individual, and I wanted them to correct it and give me my money back. And it went back and forth to the attorneys, and I went back and forth and held them accountable. And finally, I noticed the governor, which is the chief magistrate of the state, and also the attorney general. And I accepted their oath of office, validated as an equity contract, and pointed out that it was felony theft. It was actually when I, years ago, when they transported me across state lines to Illinois, that's interstate transportation of commerce. I mean, the whole damn thing, I don't know where to go with it. As far as the governor, I wrote registered letters to them explaining that and saying there was a crime committed, and I got a response from a flunky attorney out of the attorney general's office, and I held him accountable and said, you're committing treason. I went all the way through and finally wrote the governor two or three registered letters, and finally I paid $125 to have them both processed served. It's about two or three years ago. But where do I go with it? I can't find an honest court in this state.
Yeah,
I haven't lived. Oh, go ahead.
I have family that live in Iowa, and I've heard a few of these stories already. They moved there from North Dakota many years ago. And right from the very onset, it hasn't been pleasing or honorable what I've heard from Iowa. There actually are a few good judges and a few good magistrates and some elected officials there, but not a lot of them. There's a concern that the consensus is they've become drunk on their own authority and behavior, and that one man said that if the sheriff in his county pulls what he did one more time, that he was just going to shoot him because and I'm listening to this guy, and I'm saying, are you serious? He says, of course I am. And there was about 40 people listening to this gentleman at the time. And he says, of course I'm going to shoot him. I have no legitimate expectation of justice any other way. And if he thinks he can go in and arrest somebody for a vehicle infraction, in this case it was a taillight lens that was damaged and a crack in his front windshield. And he says, they arrest him and put them in jail for 3 days. It's Friday afternoon until Monday morning. And then, and they don't give him any bail. And, at that time, they don't even, give him consideration for time served. His ticket was $300 some odd, this, and he was a youngster. He was only about 54. And, he says, I don't care. If they think, you know, and we talked, he asked a similar question about filing federal charges against, the sheriff. And the sheriff's the highest elected official, and he is technically the highest law enforcement, entity in the, in any county. We have a little over 3,000 counties in the United States, and, that end, every one of them has a sheriff, and you, the, it's very sad that, it's, that they do this. And, of the 3,033 counties, there are some of them that, well, there's not much for residents there, even when they include the gophers and the jackrabbits. But the sheriff is supposed to be the highest legal authority in the county. And, Gary is considering filing a, well, let me ask you a question, John. What's the statute for wrongful arrest or against wrongful arrest? You're right. There isn't one. No answer is the correct answer. Would it possibly be kidnapping under color of law?
Kidnapping under force of arms.
Under color of law?
Yeah, it depends on the circumstances. Yeah, probably color of law. Everything they do is under color of law.
Isn't it? Yeah. So under 18 U.S.C. 241 or 18 U.S.C. 242, technically that's a felony in the second degree. And actually, kidnapping under color of law is a felony in the first degree, and it can carry capital punishment, can't it?
It sure can. Where do we go? Where do we go to get justice? Now, okay. Years ago, I did have a federal judge give me a document. I tried to remove, because of Muscatine County, the county where my farm was, the sheriff was an absolute criminal. And so I took him to task. He arrested me when I was going to arrest the county treasurer for fraud upon the tax sale. So long story short on that, I tried to remove the case to the federal court, and I didn't like the judge's ruling. He said, I do not belong in the limited jurisdiction of a U.S. district court. And I didn't like that ruling at first, but when I thought about it, that federal judge gave me the most important document I ever had, because I knew about, I think it's 28 U.S.C. 1945. I always sign everything under penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America, proving that I'm without the United States. So that judge knew that, because I signed everything that way. This goes back 15, 20 years ago, and that's why he wrote what he did. Would you agree with that?
My observations would be in concert with yours, and many others. Many other people would be in concert with yours. Let me ask you a question. I'm going to read a little excerpt from 18 U.S.C. 242. It's the last couple sentences, or last sentence or two. But, and if death results from the acts committed in violation of this section, or such acts include kidnapping or attempt to kidnap, aggravated sexual abuse, or an attempt to commit aggravated sexual abuse, or an attempt to kill, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for any term of years or for life or both, or may be sentenced to death. We're right now, literally as we speak, we're preparing a felony grand jury indictment. And in the letter that we're sending to the federal prosecutor, we're seeking the death penalty. Now, this is in a very, very corrupt jurisdiction, very. But the last time we sent anything to, well, this, he wasn't the federal prosecutor at the time. This was 22 or 24 years ago. We sent a similar letter over a similar situation. The deputy was allowed to resign under some duress, and the judge resigned and moved to Mexico within 2 weeks of the application for felony grand jury indictment, and magistrate justice resigned 3 days after the justice did. And what happened was that the person, when they found out that we were seeking the grand jury indictments, we ended up tripping over a landmine there. And the landmine was most people are not really aware of these the landmines that exist in some of these situations. But what happens is under Title 28-2072, the Supreme Court was 28 U.S.C. 2072, the Supreme through 274 was given the authority to establish the federal rules of both civil and criminal procedure and the appellate procedure. Now, what happens is that when you come to the grand jury indictment, it requests that the grand jury indictment, it explains that it has to be short and concise, and it explains what the charges are, and then of all things, it says it must be signed by a federal prosecutor. So what happens is that they prevent themselves from being prosecuted because these federal prosecutors have to work in front of them day in, day out, without any, opportunity to do anything else. And if they, so much as they breathe wrong, they, in a courtroom, it's a "you'll never work in this town again" moment. And so what we've done is we've got a new statement. I'm going to read one of the statements off of the felony grand jury indictment. Yeah. The prosecutor here, within signing and completing this, is only certifying that the form and content is required by the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, Rule 6, are complied with, and he or she in no way, shape, or form is testifying to the truthfulness or accuracy or validity of this document or the charges herein, only that it has been properly prepared and formatted. And the last three attempts, we've gotten federal prosecutors to sign the grand jury indictment.
I used to sit in, excuse me, on the grand jury, the county grand jury selection each year. The chief judge controls it, and we can't get to the grand jury. I sent a registered letter to the grand jury foreman. A friend of mine has a small newspaper, and he got the names and addresses. So the county attorney, I think the grand jury foreman got scared or whatever and turned it over to the county attorney, I'm guessing, but I never heard a thing about it. I've tried, like I say. I've been suppressed all the way. A lot of criminal activity. So where do I go? If I can't get to the grand jury when I got evidence of crimes, what do you do?
We had one in Nebraska only a couple years ago, and we went to the federal prosecutor, and she says, "Are you kidding? This is against the federal prosecutor. I'm not signing this." And the gentleman next to me, standing next to my wheelchair, said, "So you're a co-conspirator." She says, "What do you mean?" He says, "This is a true bill." And he said, there is a complaint, federal criminal complaint, and because this person's a co-worker, are you a co-conspirator, yes or no?" And she demanded to know who he was. He opened up his jacket. He's a U.S. Marshal. And his firearm was right there. And she says, "You can't carry a firearm in this building. It's a federal building. It's against the law." And I asked her, I says, "Ma'am, where in the Constitution is who the right to bear a firearm in this building, let alone the judge's courtroom that we're going to hear your case in?" She says, "Hear my case?" I says, "You just flat out said you're conspiring to deprive somebody of their civil rights under color of law, meaning this city code or this other, you know, of this inalienable right to keep and bear a firearm. I'm sorry." And I says, "You need to clarify that for me if that's what you're doing." And she says, you can't force me to do anything. And the federal marshal says, "Ma'am, we're going to need a clarification on that." He says, "What do you mean?" And he got he undid his handcuffs, and he also unsnapped, his holster. And, she says, "What are you?" And I says, "I think he's about to place you under arrest because federal marshals are the only ones that have a mandate that if they witness a felony, they're required to make an arrest. No other officer or law enforcement officer, if they witness a felony, they're not required by their mandate. Only a federal marshal is." And she says, and I said, "Wait a minute, you already knew that." And then she quietly says, "Where's the indictment?" I says, "It's still sitting on your desk." And she signed it, and she says, "I'll take it to the grand jury." Now, they she was the one that ended up presenting to the grand jury. But there's also there is nothing that states how a grand jury is constituted in a lot of jurisdictions, meaning that there's a gentleman who in Oklahoma City and in Plano, Texas, who regularly puts together a grand jury. These are state grand juries, and has had access to the voter records and knows how to do the Freedom of Information Act, get all of the qualified jurors. And he just basically sends letters to them. "Would you be interested in considering being a candidate for the local grand jury?" Last time he did that was about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And he had six cases that he wanted to have heard and ended up being heard in Plano, Texas. And I had two that I wanted heard with that. And the problem was that mine were out of state and his was a state grand jury. But the thing is that a grand jury is still a jury of the people. It doesn't have to be. Well, maybe, let me ask you a question. Where are the rules for how a grand jury is constituted? And
Corpus Juris Secundum 38A, I think. I've got a copy of it.
Okay. Now,
In this county, the county grand jury, I think it's coming up in March or also this next week. They'll go down and bring the people out of the voter registration in, or maybe it's driver's license, but they'll bring them in before the chief judge, and they'll go through their spiel and select them.
Yeah, they make most of them apply for those positions as jurors. And to that end, they pre-screen almost everyone for the grand jury. And it's rare you ever find anybody under the age of 45 on a grand jury. Did you ever notice that?
Yeah, you might get one or two, but...
Yep. On rare occasions, you might get one or two. It sounds like you know why that is, because sometimes grand go ahead.
Well, it seems like they pick the people that aren't the most educated on any of the juries, because that way the judge can lead them and instruct them the way he wants.
Well, that I wasn't going to say that out loud, you know. but
that's my opinion. That's an opinion.
Okay. Okay, and I'll accept that as an opinion. What happens is that grand juries sometimes go for days and weeks at a time, and individuals that serve on a grand jury serve for a year or two, or in certain jurisdictions up to 6 years. And there's up to 23 individuals on a grand jury. And you can have multiple grand juries constituted at the same time. There's one jurisdiction in the U.S. that they serve 6 years, and every 2 years, they reconstitute one of the three grand juries in this jurisdiction. And what happens is that individuals who are under 45 usually are self-supporting. They're not retired. They have to work, and they end up under moderate to extreme duress, and they're not able to fulfill the responsibilities of being a grand jury. In fact, they get to a place where they resent it to the point where they won't give the prosecutor any kind of favorable ruling. And so there's multiple reasons that why you rarely ever see anybody under the age of 45 on a grand jury. But at the same time, go ahead. You had something to share?
No, that makes a lot of sense. The county attorney said that county grand juror served for 1 year. And he said the grand jury was only convened twice in 15 years that he was a county attorney.
Yeah, there's there's one jurisdiction where it's on the West Coast, the Northwest there, that the grand juries are seated for 2 years, but during the year of 2017 to 2019, they didn't go a single week in over 2 years that they were not hearing a cause. And
it should be that way.
That's true. And what happened was is that a case that I was working on. We were about to bring the sheriff up for a grand jury indictment. I don't know if you remember a few years back, the riots that were occurring in a lot of the cities on the West Coast and, you know, in the upper Northwest states, you know, he was part and parcel to precipitating that. And, multiple individuals that were defending their community, honest and honorable, were detained just because they were the opposite party. And I try never to use names. This particular sheriff didn't like that and had patrol cars following these individuals and harassing them to the point where we actually had to get motion for temporary injunction permit restraining order. And we went through four levels of court to finally get a motion for temporary injunction permanent restraining order against three of the sheriff deputies that were doing this harassment. And it was not easy. And, you know, it's something that is borderline the term abominable doesn't even begin to apply. And you remember Thomas Jefferson's quote about the Tree of Liberty?
Yes. So liquid should be shed every 20 years?
I've never heard that take on that before. That's good.
I figure that's political. I think that's politically correct.
I've never heard that take before, John. I've never heard that take. Yeah. But
carrying a firearm into a court, we can't even carry a cell phone into ours. They've restricted. The chief judge put out an order that she doesn't have the right to legislate. In the same way, the law now, I have the right to carry a arm into any building, any public building. But the sheriff put out the rule you can't carry a firearm or an arm into the courthouse. And he doesn't have the right to legislate. But where do I go?
Yeah.
I got nowhere to go with it. I know they're committing crimes, but.
I was pushing my wheelchair through a courthouse just the other day. And I asked the, and I just happened to have a federal marshal with me. The deputies that were monitoring the metal scanners there, I had a flat, plasma cut tracing of a Smith & Wesson revolver, in my ag bag. It's only about 40 thousandths thick, you know, but I asked them in advance, I says, what would you do if I attempted to, bring a firearm into the courtroom? All of a sudden, two of the others that were on the other machines that there was no line at, and I was the only one that was going through this one, he says, well, you know that's against the law. And I says, And I asked him, and they hadn't taken my bag off my wheelchair to put it through the scanner yet. And I says, does anybody have a cell phone on them? And they all says, yeah. I says, anybody look up 18 USC 242? And all but one of them got out their phone. This is 18 U.S. and they quoted, you know, anybody deprives him of their civil rights. But one of them jumped in and says, I know what that statute is. And I says, good. Where in the Constitution does it exclude the right to keep and bear a firearm? Does it alienate that inalienable right to keep and bear a firearm, even in this courtroom or this court building? And they all of a sudden, and two of them started everybody else freaked out. Two of them started laughing. They says, let me guess, are you carrying? And I says, anybody know what the federal marshal's mandate is? If he witnesses a felony, that he's required to detain anybody? Three of them said yes, and I says, how do you know? He says, well, I'm a federal marshal. I says, really? How wonderful. I says, deprivation of civil rights under color of law. It says, anybody know what the statute for wrongful arrest is? One of them, he just says, I can tell you that. There isn't one. I says, yeah, it's kidnapping under color of law, isn't it? And five of the nine that were there just all of a sudden, you know, both headlights were on bright and the intake like a bug catcher or a bird catcher on a 426 Hemi dragster opened up wide, you know. I just then my bag went through there and a bunch of them started to reach for their guns. I says, this federal marshal, if he witnesses you committing a felony, depriving me of my civil right to keep bear a firearm, he's forced to arrest you. And he goes, well, I says, you're the only one that's mandated, aren't you, if you witness a felony? And they all took their hands off their belts, you know, and then the gentleman that was with me, he was appearing as a witness. He says, I'm glad you guys all took your hands off your belts. because I didn't want to shoot any of you resisting arrest. He says, who are you? And he opened up his jacket. He was also a federal marshal and has a gun there and everything. And the last couple times I went in that courthouse, you know, they and I pulled out the little, by the way, guys, this isn't really a firearm. This is, you know, it's a show and tell for the court hearing today, you know. And they all of a sudden started laughing and giggling. Says, Jimmy, you were you gonna actually have us arrested? I says, ma'am, that marshal right over there that works with you was going to be forced to arrest you, not me. I says, correct me if I'm wrong. What was your name? And I know his last name was Wilburn. I don't remember his first name, but it is Marshal Wilburn. I never knew his first name. But he says, I says, would you have been compelled to arrest them no matter what, even to your life's blood? And I said, and he frowned and he looked down. And he was very glum. He says, I would have. He says, the thing that bothers me is some of these are my friends. And the thing that bothers me even more is that some of them are good shots. You know, but he said that, John. You know, the thing that bothers me. Michael, you had a comment?
Yeah, I'm privy to what your schedule is tonight and your workload after the call tonight. So I politely, respectfully ask you to kind of wrap this up.
Okay. John, every time I go into that courthouse or any other, I ask those questions. When they see me coming now, they don't even ask me to take my bag off my wheelchair. They don't inspect me. They don't nothing. And other people says, well, if he bought a firearm in the courtroom, he says, well, if he bought a knife in here, we'd have to ask you to leave it at the thing. But if you bought the firearm in, we can't stop you. And they've actually said that in front of other people. And we've been asking these questions for years. Texas is a open carry law state and everything else. But John, though a man seeks an audience with a king, it's from the Lord he gets justice, okay? It's though a man seeks an audience with a doctor, it's from God he gets healing. Quietly, what we need to do in your jurisdiction is start learning to ask the correct thought-provoking questions so that the people we're dealing with, I don't threaten people. I found people get defensive and all of a sudden there's a wall there and communication is non-existent. But if I ask them thought-provoking questions, here's the thing that's really wild and scary about it. They ask their friends and then they start to search and research. And then they find out that what they're doing is wrong. And now because I asked the question, John, and I let them research out the statutes, I don't have an adversarial relationship with them. In fact, many of them are quite friendly. And it's not easy. And Thomas Jefferson, you know, Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. I understand where he came from. When that lady, when he was walking away from the Second Continental Congress, and the lady asked him, the widow asked him, good sir, what kind of government have you given us? He says, a republic, if you have the temerity of character to keep it. And when they enacted the Second Amendment, it wasn't for hunting. It was because to keep the hired help under control. It was not.
Absolutely. Can I point out an error that you're making on firearm?
Please.
Okay. Go back and look at the 1934 Firearm Control Act. You'll find out there's only four things that are listed as firearms. And even when they came out in Congress, I don't know, my opinion is fraudulently passed that 1968 Firearm Control Act. They referenced the 1934, but it was passed because of Capone and the gang. A full-blown machine gun, a sawed-off shotgun, a sawed-off rifle with a short barrel, less than 16 inches, I think, and a silencer. Those are the only four things that are considered a firearm. So I don't own any firearms. I put it on the public record that I own arms, and arms are for the right of protection for myself, anybody around me, and property. And the one good sheriff, he understood that. In fact, I wouldn't allow anybody on the farm unless they signed an affidavit.
That's originally called the NFA Act, correct? That's the NFA Act.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, in case they don't want you to know about, go ahead.
Yeah. Now, some of the local constabulary have been personal friends of mine. The previous sheriff here, Ron, actually I shouldn't use names. I signed him off for his high performance rating for his Beechcraft Bonanza so he could fly the new Bonanza that he bought, 15, 20 years ago. Who was the, sheriff all through the 90s here, he was personal friends also. And, one time I was leaving a gun show at, the George R. Brown Convention Center and, three ATF agents, took this gentleman. He says, look, where's your yellow sheet on this? Where was the yellow sheet? And he says, there's a personal transfer in here. And they started to jump him and they started to put him in handcuffs. And four gentlemen that were standing around me all of a sudden surrounded these, ATF agents. And one of them pulled out a service revolver and stuck it right in the guy's eye. He says, what are you doing? He says, I'm a local deputy sheriff. And he has the right to keep bear firearm wherever it's at. And he says, we're ATF, Fed Trump's the state. And all of a sudden another one pulled out his firearm and he says, I'm sorry, the Fed doesn't trump the state here. And he shoved it into his neck underneath his chin. And a good friend of mine, Dan, almost pulled his concealed carry at the time. And then two more deputy sheriffs pulled out one of the ATF agents. They put him under arrest. One of the ATF agents apparently repented of his bad attitude. That was Saturday. The other two, they kept him in jail till Monday morning. And the sheriff back then, they got apparently there was an entourage that came out from the Fed, from parts east from the Hill. And they says, look, you can't do this. These are Fed. And he says, no, they're not. They're committing federal and state crimes. And they were referring to the, deprivation of civil rights under color of law. And he says, both of those other agents, they were eventually released, but they were allowed to leave the ATF to pursue other, activities. They showed up again in Austin. 10 months later at a gun show there and started checking everybody's, yellow sheet. And, I may have been a class three at one time until, 1994. And I quit under the Slick Willie administration. May have quit. And, I'm a card carrying, instructor, and I'm a CRSO, a Chief Range Safety Officer, you asked the right questions, and I was a precinct judge a little while back, and the new sheriff was there, and I says, hey, how come your holster's empty? Well, I can't carry one on the, this is a voting and it's also a school. It's an elementary school. It's in session. I said, and I asked him and I looked at him right in the eye and he looked down at me and I was in a wheelchair. I says, where in the Constitution does a school the right to keep bear a firearm in this school, let alone the courthouse where you might be charged? And he looked at me and he was so shocked. That very question caused him, to question what he was doing. And I says, I'm honored and pleased. And by the way, I'm the presiding judge here. And also, you know, and the following time when he was there, I was what they call a poll watcher. And I don't know if you know what a poll watcher is, but in Texas,
yeah.
They if somebody's going to jail, the poll watcher is the highest lawful enforcement authority during an election. If somebody's going to jail, it's because that poll watcher placed them under arrest. And I says, I'm the poll watcher here. It'd be my honor and privilege to have you wear your firearm in this election, in this precinct. You know, and he looked at me dead shocked. And that was two separate elections, 2 years apart, that he showed up. And now he carries his firearm everywhere, even in the criminal court buildings where they said you don't. But it's, and he doesn't, the amount of arrests that are occurring for firearms are almost non-existent. We've got along with,
well, should be,
onto a lot of, go ahead.
The sheriff should, he has the right to. I used to be a hunter safety instructor, and I could go into the schools and teach handgun safety and all that. Now they've forbidden that, and the kids really need to know, because I teach them how to make every weapon safe, unload it, pull the magazine first and save lives. And it's,
yeah,
it's well, crazy.
Back in the 60s, when my family's originally from North Dakota, but back in the 60s when my family used to go to the origins of our family up in Fargo, North Dakota, and Foreman, there were times where individuals were, I would go to school while we were on spring vacation or summer school, etc. And they still, back then, the kids would bring their 22s and their 20 gauges to school in their 12 gauges in the back of that two-room
yep.
schoolhouse, along with the, you know, the hip boots and slickers and the rain gear and everything else, whereas, racks for, and hooks for pistols and racks for shotguns and rifles. Because the kids used
those
to
are the good old days.
On the way home. Well,
yep.
They're taking, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, the felony is not a 61-year-old school teacher that has a Lady Smith in her purse. It's the eight officers that jumped her, broke her ribs, broke her arm, and then placed her under arrest, and they were all committing the felonies.
Oh, I know. It's a wicked society. In 2003... I had left a Super X Model 1 ski grade at a gun dealer's to sell, and it didn't sell in a year, and I was headed to Arkansas, and they changed the law to where I had to fill out the yellow form, and I knew that I was not a U.S. citizen, I was in Iowa, so I'm talking to the FBI, and I'm going down there, and they got all pissy about that, excuse my language, about me saying I wasn't a U.S. citizen, and I just said, well, forget it, and I hung up. And I told the guy, hang on to the gun. I went down to Arkansas, and I brought four ATF agents into the Quad City area. And when I got back, I basically sold the gun for less than what I really wanted. But I gave it up because I felt that the people of Southwest Davenport needed a gun store. And I knew the guy was honorable. And I felt I could go to court, but it cost him $60,000 to defend it. And I didn't want him to bear that, so... I guess you did my
yeah.
good deed, but.
There's, you know, Michael Edwards made a statement about restoring liberty to America. And there's, John, you, I can't imagine how horrible you feel with what you've been through. By the way, what branch did you serve in?
I served in the Navy. I went to Long Beach out of boot camp, and I served on a minesweeper, and the old farm kid I was strong, I just did what I was told. I was selected out of all the sailors in Long Beach, California to serve on the Pacific Mine Force Admiral's barge, and it happened to be Wrigley's yacht. So I learned how
oh,
to run
boy.
that yacht. It was a chief. I was made third class, and the chief petty officer was the skipper. And I once we hit the breakwater, I ran the thing. I even brought the admiral and his wife in with the chief standing behind me. And I just got bored and wanted to run a patrol boat. So I volunteered to go to Vietnam, thinking it was my duty, and got shot at once. or twice, came back and thought there was truth, honesty, and justice. And I found out, unfortunately, that even if you learn the law and know it and stand up for your rights, sometimes you run into a buzzsaw. And I've got friends. We have a monthly meeting. And in this state, I'll tell you what, a lot of people are pretty sharp, and we're bucking our heads against the brick wall.
Yeah. You were, where when you started, you were only a mile and a half from the hangar where Howard Hughes had the goose.
I saw that. We went out, yep, I saw that.
Remember that PB5Y2C that used to be in there, that Coronado? You know, that little four-engine Grumman seaplane? You ever see that one in the hangar also?
I didn't see that, but there at Long Beach, there, they had one. They had one sitting there. They changed the oil once a month, but it just sat there.
I was one of the people that helped restore that aircraft.
Well, Howard Hughes had a 99-year lease on that Long Beach Naval Station, and as soon as that lease went up, Bill Clinton sold that port to the Chinese.
Yep, clear on the concept. But getting back to your issue, what Michael Edwards was saying about making a difference and restoring liberty to America. We have to do that one step at a time, one person at a time, one law at a time, one statute at a time. And, we're not, you know, this is an elephant. John, how do you eat an elephant?
A very small forkful at a time.
One bite at a time. That's right.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing. And so to that end, I would love to chat with you some more sometime. Some of your situation, we may be able to engender some litigation to help give you some personal relief. But right now, your community and your state needs relief. And the way we need to do that is by honest, honorable communication with our fellow person. What was that old saying? You shall know the truth, and the truth shall what?
Set you free.
Yes. And so to that end, let's work together, you know, let's see if we can chat a little bit more often, and maybe sometime during the day, call Michael up and see if we can, you and I can schedule a conference call. And what we need to do is start looking very specifically at some of the issues there, the very specific issues, and see if we can formulate the right thought-provoking questions to ask our fellow person, our law enforcement, our legislators, our judiciary in your area, the right question that leaves it so embarrassingly obvious that what they're doing is criminally wrong that they decide they have to choose to stop. That way we don't have to worry about Thomas. We don't really have to go quite to Thomas Jefferson's note there.
Well, I've read to the good book twice, and I have a good rapport with the bailiffs, and I even ask them once they pass the law that I had the right to go in any public building in this state. I never got a permit. I didn't believe in asking permission. I always had the right and didn't feel I needed to carry. But I ask them. I says, now that the law is such, what would you do if I came in here and I came through the scanner with my arm, and he said I'd arrest you, and they'd put me in jail overnight, and that I knew right away they'd violate my rights, but I just don't know where to go. Not with the crooked judges.
Well, no.
That's the problem.
That's a great place to. You're absolutely in the. It's wonderful, John. You're John. Oh, you're the right person. This is great.
Well, I talked to bailiffs.
Yeah, here's what you do. When the bailiff asked that, ask them to pull out their cell phone, you know, if they got a smartphone, and have them look up 18 U.S.C. 242. Have them ask, say, do you have a cell phone? You know what? I've heard something about this. Could you look this up for me? You know, and maybe read it to me real quick. I'm told it's real short. It's only a couple sentences. 18 U.S.C. 242. And you ask them. Don't tell them. But you ask them, can you look this up for me and read it to me real quick? And, you know, and when they read that, Then I asked him, where in the Constitution does it exclude my right to keep bear a firearm in this building, let alone that judge's courtroom? Well, where does it alienate my inalienable right to keep bear a firearm? You know, and regardless of what they feel compelled to do, that, you know, that if you actually had one, that they would need to arrest you, what you've done is you've seeded them with a thought-provoking question, and I have had individuals, two of them that used to be local police or constables actually here in Houston, or actually on the north side, that the person that used to be the head constable and the deputy head constable, he said that, John, you screwed me really bad. And he was at this one officer, one constable was at my son's Eagle Court of Honor about 10 years ago, and he says, you screwed me really bad. Two of my best deputies resigned because of the questions you asked them. I says, what do you mean, Jim? He says, you asked him about where in the Constitution does he have the right to keep bear a firearm in this courtroom in precinct four here, place two. And Jim says, you know, I wish you wouldn't have asked that, but he says, I'm glad you did. He says, and he said, those two, both those guys you asked that resigned because they couldn't, at the time, they didn't feel they could do their job properly and honor the Constitution. So,
well, they had a good moral compass.
John?
Yeah, I think our time has come to a close.
Feel free to give me a call on Thursday. I got a VA appointment tomorrow.
John, you call me. Call me when you're clear. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for joining us this evening. I want to remind you again, please, to return tomorrow night. Listen to Mr. Slevin talk about a limited liability company that can absolutely take an employee and translate them into a worker, which means you go from being a taxpayer to a non-taxpayer. If you're an entrepreneur, learn how to rearrange your affairs in such a way that you've basically reduced your tax footprint to zero. All this can be learned on tomorrow night's call. Any closing comments, John, that you'd like to make?
John, thank you for the honor and the privilege of joining us tonight. I thank you. And I thank you also for your honorable service to this country.
Amen. Martin, you want to close us home? Take us home?
All right, folks. We'll see everybody back here again tomorrow night. Until then, have a good evening and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.